Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you.
Hello, everyone. We have another insightful conversation from the academic leadership here at UB. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Smith. Today, I'm excited to speak with my guest about Bahamian literature. We'll be discussing the importance of Bahamian stories written in and by Bahamian voices and the necessity of reading and writing about who we are. Joining me today are two remarkable Bahamian literary artists who are making waves both nationally and internationally. Today we have Alexia Tolis, an award-winning writer who has recently returned to the Bahamas and is preparing to publish her debut novel with an international publisher. Her writing has been featured widely, and she is a standout among up-and-coming writers in the Caribbean region. Rhys Knowles, a talented fiction writer who recently won an international literary prize for his short story, Sponge Monkey. His debut book, Between Islands, was just published by Ponciana Press, a local Bahamian publishing press. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Awesome. So today with you guys, I think we'll be exploring the significance of Bahamian storytelling, the role of literature in our society, and how we can foster more opportunities for Bahamians to write and publish their work. Let's talk about it a little bit. Let's get started. Let's start with you, Alexia. Tell us about your background and how you came to your passion for writing.
Okay, well, I was born in Providence, but I moved to Long Island for high school, and it was there that I gained a passion for reading. You know, there's not a whole lot to do on the outer islands or family islands, so the library became my safe space. And eventually, you kind of run out of books to read, so you start to think about what you can do, and it inspired me to write on my own. Of course, attending the College of the Bahamas and being a part of the literature program there also inspired me, because we got a chance to read books from writers around the Caribbean, but also from the Bahamas. So that gave me a little more boost to write on my own. But it wasn't until 2016 that I started to write short stories. I always knew that I wanted to feature my country, my island, and the people that I grew up with. So that's what I do. I focus on small island communities and the people who live there and their lived experiences.
All right, Alexia, and your writing has gained international recognition for its deep and nuanced portrayals of Bahamian culture, and also a very different sort of take on Bahamian culture. And I'm thinking of Grandma's Porch, for instance. So I'm wondering, what themes in Bahamian life most inspire you and your storytelling? And how do you bring those elements to life in your work?
I think what most inspires me would be, I guess, the journey from childhood to adulthood, but also thinking about themes of class and race, and what those marginalized spaces in between. I forgot the second half of your question. I'm so sorry.
That's fine. Yeah, just that, the themes of Bahamian life that inspire you and, you know, how you bring those elements to life in your work.
Yeah, I also like to explore some of the bits of culture that we don't talk about often. I think that it's mostly inspired by my teaching experience. You know, when I started teaching, I think it was in 2017, and we were looking at like the BJC and BGCSC coursework, we got a chance to work with students on Bahamian folktales, but a lot of them didn't really understand things like Obeya. They didn't really relate to the themes of the small island experience. And I felt kind of sad, because those are the kind of stories that I grew up reading and the kind of stories that my grandmother told, my uncles told, my mother told. So I felt like there was something just being lost there. But even having conversations with people my own age, they also didn't really understand it fully. So then I thought, well, do I understand it as much as I think I do? So I guess like doing more research and trying to find those, texts that could help me understand my own culture made me want to write more about it. So that's why I like to explore those themes. I want to keep something alive, something that we're not seeing as much.
And one of the things I've noticed between your work and Reese's work in some ways is a reclamation of history. And you do it in one of your short stories, this recollect reclamation and recollection, I guess, of language. Can you talk a little bit about that and that story?
Yes, so that's No Man's Land. That took me years to write. I'm a little ashamed to say how many drafts I went through with that one. At first, when I began writing the story, I wanted to write it in full Bahamian Creole. But then I spoke to a couple of friends who are deep into linguistics, and they asked me, would a Chekchani speak in Bahamian Creole like completely, or would there be elements of the indigenous people? So once again, great question that took me into some deep research, and I just found some information on resurrected Taíno. They're doing a lot of research in Puerto Rico, and that just led me there, and it just felt more authentic that way. I'm happy that I was able to have those those talks with my colleagues, because I hadn't thought about it in that depth. And I think that's another thing that I would like to talk about, community, having a literary community or artistic community to bounce ideas off of. But so we're borrowing some of the language that's been resurrected in different parts of the Caribbean and incorporating it as authentically as possible into my work. And it's also been very interesting to see how that affects the way that we think about land, the way that we think about ownership, the way we think about how deeply we are rooted in our own country, considering that we are all coming from different parts of the world, whether by choice or by force.
Nice. Yes, I like that. I want to get back to that idea of that language and reclamation of language, and what you think, how you think that adds to the idea of Bahamian identity, but Caribbean identity at large, and that bringing together of people from across the Caribbean diaspora through language. But we can talk about that in a little bit. Reese, let's get you into the conversation. How did you come to your love of writing and storytelling? And how did you learn to hone those skills?
So I've always been obsessed with English lit. I remember having like transformative experiences with text early on, whether it be Franz Kafka or as interesting as Becca Lamb by Z. Edgell. And since then, I've kind of like crafted my writing style and my writing voice by combining both regional and international authorial influences. So Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Also, I'm thinking about Arundhati Roy, writers who are working in post-colonial contexts, and specifically Caribbean writers who are interrogating ideas regarding, like Alexia, class, race, but also the landscape and our political and economic history, which even in the Bahamas is especially unique with respect to the wider Caribbean region. So I would say, like literature itself, almost absorbed me. And I went on to later refine my writing, both in an academic context, but also in a variety of personal and private endeavors. So I submitted lots of stories to different competitions. And when I found that I was receiving good news, I decided to pursue it more seriously. And I'm also a writer, not only in a creative context, but also in a professional context. So across academic, professional, and personal environments, I've had the opportunity to sharpen my craft and also be affirmed by people close to me, far from me. And that has been a tremendous help in establishing confidence as a writer, which is not an easy thing to do, specifically when there aren't so many precedents to follow the footsteps of.
One of the things that interests me about you is that you sort of straddle the fence, right? I wonder because, as you say, you do your creative writing and then you do another type of writing in your professional life. I wonder how one informs the other.
Well, I think in both. So I'm a speech writer and I'm also a fiction writer. I think speech writing that helps my fiction writing because it's not necessarily my voice which I'm trying to write in, and I feel like specifically if you're doing a first person narrative, you really have to get into the headspace and the perspective of your main character. And I think having to do that every day for work makes it come more naturally to me. And you also have to consider if you're speech writing your audience and how it's going to be received. So you're really considering what you're arguing and what kind of impact would you would like to have. And I feel like those are things that I'm not exactly trying to do in my fiction, because I wouldn't say that I'm particularly trying to convince a reader. But I am typically trying to raise an issue and promote a critical interrogation of an issue. So I think that helps strengthen my creative writing practice. But I think one way in which the two are quite different is that speech writing is very tangible. It's very much rooted in reality, and it's also it's let's say it's instrumental. I think I enjoy fiction because it's sort of useless if we're talking about let's say material outcomes. It's creative, it's just expressive. It can be like its own end, for instance. You don't need to really instrumentalize it. And I think that's what I appreciate about writing fiction. I can really dive into a topic, explore somebody's perspective, raise an interesting idea, and that is enough. And I feel like that is already quite a lot. And whether or not somebody fully takes what I have to say on board or not, I'm content with the fact that I've raised an issue, and it is circulating out there, and people can come to it how they would like to.
Yeah. And also, Reese, you're talking about your stories, but a big congratulations is in order for you. You just launched your book. You just had your book launch this past weekend, Between Islands. So congratulations on that. I had the honor of reading your book ahead of the launch. And just to talk a little bit, many of your stories reflect the realities of Bahamian life in much the ways of Alexia's work. But your stories do it in quite a unique way. And you mentioned Marquez a little bit earlier on. So can you talk to us a little bit about your writing style and what was your process in selecting the stories that you've added to this collection, Between Islands?
So first of all, thank you very much. I was delighted at the success of the launch. We did sell out all the copies, but we have some extra copies that we've secured, and those are available both at the National Art Gallery and also Rabble Bookshop at Ponciana Paper Press on Parkgate Road. So when it came to selecting the stories for the collection, the earliest story I wrote was in 2019. I was actually in the States at that time, and that story, called Friday Visits, had won a prize. And that prize really, let's say, motivated me to pursue writing more seriously. So I then engaged in two writing residencies in the region, one in Barbados and one in Aruba. And during the latter, I wrote another short story, Sponge of Money, which went on to win the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival Award for Writers in the Caribbean. So I had, let's say, accumulated lots of different stories, which I felt echoed. They had similar ideas. It was typically maybe one to two main characters which were undergoing some kind of sudden transformation in a surreal scenario. And I think in general that's really what I'm interested in. I'm exploring really what happens here, and what is very everyday, but perhaps to an outside audience will seem surreal, uncanny, and perhaps even strange. So I'm trying to really zoom in on those features of Bahamian life, and indeed Caribbean life at large, which are quite dramatic and stunning and surreal, but nevertheless Possible. So, in one of the stories in the collection, it opens with droves of stingrays kind of descending onto this key, and these are dead stingrays now. And this is the first of a series of plagues, in this story, which is titled The Key. And in that story, I was really playing with the idea of the island itself resisting this luxury tourism model, which is operating on top of it. Let's put it like that. But at the same time, it's a romance story. It's dealing with how not only how tourists escape, but how Bahamians are trying to escape reality in their own country. What are the ways in which we're in exile, or how are we alienated and seeking to leave behind trauma or difficulty in some kind of way? So I think in general, all the stories are really looking at dramatic events. That have a significant influence on the main character, and whether that's the collapse of an entire industry like sponging, or an environmental extreme, we kind of go through the lives of these characters who are quite quirky. The men tend to be a little troubled, the women tend to be quite contrary, and we're just really with them as they grapple with the everyday in the Bahamas, which is naturally quite surreal.
Yeah, and you say dramatic, dramatic, but also somewhat traumatic as well. And I think that in Alexia's work, we also see that trauma or expressions of it anyway. How important is that in terms of when we're writing about Bahamian people, right? And not just the landscape, and not the landscape in the way that it's presented in tourist brochures, right? Because Reese, I think in your work you write about the landscape in ways that is antithetical to the narrative that's being put out there, right? But you both write about Bahamian people as well, and I think it's important to get people in these stories in the land, right? Because oftentimes when we think about the narratives about the Bahamas, it's sun, sand, and sea. So why or how is it, why is it important for you all to present these people and to the, present these people who are dealing often with drama and trauma?
Well, I'll speak about the Friday Visit story, which is the earliest story in the collection. With that story, which is about an older woman with who's a single mother, who her community has alienated her because the Friday visits she's having go against the prevailing idea, without spoiling too much, idea of how a woman of her age or a woman in general should behave. And so I wanted to write that story because there's not only kind of like that trauma of being socially alienated, there's a bit of family trauma as well, which I again won't spoil. And I wanted to write that story to see if it was possible for that person to be reincorporated into her community. I wasn't sure how the story was going to end. I almost wrote the story as a way to be hopeful. As a way to imagine how somebody could heal from that situation, whether or not that was available or possible. So I would say it's for me, it's very important, even if the story does not have necessarily a happy ending. I think it's important for fiction to imagine how the characters might overcome, or how they might negotiate both present and past traumas. Because I think fiction can be instructive. I think it can give you an idea of how to live your life or an idea of how not to live it. So that story was very important for me because, and after I read it every time I almost start crying because I really was like, I didn't think that this particular ending would work. And for me, I felt writing the story, I was engaging in a pretty radical act of hope. And healing. And for me, I feel like fiction can really be a source of hope and healing, in the wake of trauma.
Wonderful. Alexia, same question.
Yeah, I was thinking about what Ethan was saying, and it's this idea of it's the same for me, right? It's about reintroducing people who've been isolated from their communities to their communities. I think that one of the advantages of being in an archipelago is that we have so many different iterations of what Bahamian culture is. But at the same time, when you're removed from that community, you tend to feel isolated. I wanted to, in my work, to kind of reintroduce characters to their communities, but also to talk about what happens in those communities, because I think as a Caribbean writer and a Bahamian writer in particular, we kind of have this natural resistance against the tourist narrative or the kind of brochures like you're talking about. I'm so sorry. Can you hear all of that on the next side of the room?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, I am so sorry.
It's
They
fine. Your
have.
voice is louder.
Okay, very good. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about what happens in a community that's given into the idea of paradise, and we kind of try to create an idealized version of what our histories and what our presence are like. We also kind of cloak ourselves in religion, we cloak ourselves in this politeness. I wanted to kind of tear those veils away so we can see what's actually happening, so we can have conversations about the true lived experiences of Bahamian people. And unfortunately, because we do so much hiding, because we try to hide behind the niceties, we do experience a lot of trauma. So yeah, apart from trying to bring communities back, it's about also having those conversations to understand why the communities are falling apart in the first place.
I would
Amazing.
add,
Oh.
if I could just jump in, I think it's very important for Bahamians to be writing Bahamian stories because the media landscape is so asymmetrical. It's very easy to consume media from perhaps North America, but it's quite difficult to understand or access creative outputs, not just regionally but nationally. And so I find, unless you know somebody from perhaps Andres, you might not know very much about Andres if you grew up in New Providence or another island. So there's a way in which cultural workers need to collect this information and synthesize it into cultural products, because there is let's say, a certain kind of media domination which we're all subjected to. So I think that's something that always preoccupies me and why I was so interested in writing a short story collection which was set entirely in the Bahamas, because growing up I did not read very much literature through the schooling system which was set in the Bahamas. So for me that's quite an important part of my practice as well.
All right, perfect. Let's put a pin in the conversation. We're going to take our first break and then we'll come back to finish our conversation. So stay with us as we continue our conversations on increasing the production of our own Bahamian stories. We'll be right back.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies, and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
My name is Jeannie Gibson. I'm the policy assistant here at the Government and Public Policy Institute. The series that we normally do on a quarterly basis, one of those is Meet the Policymakers series, is to actually engage the policymakers to discuss relevant policies to what's going on relating to those policies here in the country, as well as to give the public an opportunity to hear and actually discuss it with the policymakers.
Welcome back to University Drive. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Smith, and your guests are writers Reese Knowles and Alexia Tolis. And so before we left off, we were talking about the inspiration and the importance of Bahamian writers and the uniqueness of the Bahamian writer's voice in representing the Bahamian experiences in all its complexities. So let's talk a little bit about publishing. Alexia, you're about to publish your first novel, hopefully very soon, yes, with an international publisher. What has that journey been like for you? And how do you navigate the process as a Bahamian writer?
Well, I'm still currently in the works. I'm about two-thirds of the way through my second draft of the manuscript. So we haven't started querying just yet, but I have signed on to an agent. That was an incredible journey. It's a bit different from what writers would usually expect. I think that because of my background in, you know, short story writing, and I was lucky enough to win a few competitions, my journey's been a bit different. So rather than having to send my work out, I had agents query me. And I was also lucky enough to attend a university that put writers in contact with agents and with publishers. So yeah, it was a lot easier, I guess, my journey, but it was still nerve-wracking. You know, to have someone look at your work from an international stage, it's a bit different from home. Because when you're home, you have people who understand what you're writing about. They understand the themes, they understand the culture, they understand the people. Even during my master's program, while a lot of my classmates were willing to, you know, to let me take them on the journey through my experience, there were often times where there were a lot of questions about things that seemed so natural and common to me that was completely, you know, new to them. And sometimes I felt a little bit lonely having to explain the things that were so natural to me. But what also made me feel very happy was that so many people were interested in these new experiences. Well, for them, it's new. Mm-hmm. And what I particularly enjoyed was that there is a thirst for Caribbean literature. And I think that the Bahamas is in a particularly advantageous position, because we have so many stories to tell, but we're also a country that comes to mind quite often. So I did not have to, unlike some of my classmates, explain where I was from. They know where the Bahamas is and they want to know a little bit more about it. So I think that this is a very good time, it's a ripe time for us to introduce our stories to the international platform.
Amazing. Reese, your stories were published locally. What has the experience been like for you working with a local press? And what do you think are the advantages or challenges of publishing at home?
So I would definitely begin by saying that I didn't feel like, for instance, I had to do very much explaining, because I was working very closely with a Bahamian publisher. I was able to sort of explain maybe my vision for the piece, but not having to do all of this cultural translation. So for me, that was quite encouraging, because I felt seen and I felt understood. My publisher was also instrumental in some of the developmental editing of some of the stories. So Sonia Farmer, really, she helped me craft and refine the work in a way which I don't think I would have been able to do perhaps with an international editor / publisher, specifically in a collection which is so focused on the Bahamas. So I felt like that was an advantage. I will say that it is a lot of work to publish a book. I found out a lot during the process that I didn't know goes into it. So for instance, because it was basically just two of us doing like the writing, the book design, sourcing the cover art, you know, proofing, etc., everything. So I learned that there are so many different specializations which contribute to the realization of a literary project. So having to kind of try on different roles and really exercise maybe my graphic design, but also my writing, was an eye-opening experience. So perhaps with an international publisher that that might be smoother and easier. But I also feel like we were a great team. So I not only got a good finished product out of it, I feel like I've really strengthened a relationship with a local cultural worker who shares my vision and shares my passion for Bahamian literature. So I think there is the limitation regarding reach. So for instance, it's with a smaller press and less resources on the writer's side, it's not as easy to get the book into different bookshops all over the region. For instance, I had a couple of friends in Trinidad asking me if they could get it there, and I was like, not yet. But it is available on Amazon, and it is available locally. We were able to get it into a storefront in Long Island, which is cool because some of the stories are set there. That was in Salt Pond. So we're working on getting it into more family island spaces. And I think, I enjoyed the intimacy of the process. So I think for my first project, I felt like it worked really well. I learned a lot. I also had to plan a whole book launch, so I felt like an event planner too. So let's say I sharpened new skills.
You became a jack of many trades during
Exactly.
this process. And the great thing about working with Sonia Fama as well, more than a publisher, she is also an award-winning writer as well, creative writer as well. So that must have been beneficial to your experience working with her.
Absolutely. There are a couple times when maybe I wanted to finish a story and I felt maybe content with it, and she kind of pushed me to go further with it. So I really appreciated her insights and her motivation, because I think you get fatigued, and I really felt like if I didn't have somebody in my corner who understood where the work was coming from, I wouldn't have realized a product or like a book to the same degree or the same caliber. So I'm tremendously grateful to have worked with Sonia Farmer from Poinciana Paper Press.
Now, for both of you, what advice would you give to Bahamian writers seeking publication, both locally and internationally? Alexia?
Well, I mean, my advice would be to just be brave. I've spoken to quite a few of my friends who, they used to write, they don't write much anymore, and it was more so kind of a fear of the work being rejected. A fear that the work wouldn't be understood. And I think sometimes we fear success itself because we don't know where a story's going to go. We don't know who it's going to reach. So, when it comes to writing, you can write for yourself and that's great. But if you want to have your work shared with the world or with your country, it's about just putting the work out there. One of the great ways to build that confidence is to get readers. There's a lot of people who, they write their work and they keep it in their laptops and that's where it stays. But giving it to people that you know and trust to read, or even building a community of other people who are interested in writing and getting their work out there, meeting those people, finding those people, building that community, that's what helps you build that courage to send it off. My first story was actually accepted by a local anthology. So that was Woman Speak. And it was incredibly difficult for me to send that off the first time because I was very, very afraid that the editor was going to say, well, she has no idea what she's talking about. What does she know about Gollancz? What does she know about this experience? When I sent my first piece abroad, I was afraid that they were going to think, what is she even saying? Because I wrote it like partially in Bahamian Creole. So there was that fear. And, it did get rejected the first couple of times I sent it out. So the second story that I had accepted into a magazine that got rejected 7 times, but speaking to one of my mentors, Tobias Bukel, his first story was I think rejected 149 times, I think he said. So it's just about being willing to put the work out there. And then if it's rejected, just taking the time to go over it, think about what you could do. Or sometimes it's about just finding the right place for it. So thinking about where else it might possibly fit. And then if it's accepted, keep writing some more.
Yeah, so I would add to that that I think for me it was really encouraging to win or at least place in some early essay competitions during my secondary education. I recall feeling very let's say reaffirmed when I won I think it was a Martin Luther King essay competition. I think that was grade 11 or so. So that kind of leads into my second point, which would be that experiment with different writing forms. So it could be essays, but you could also write a letter to the editor or an op-ed in the newspaper, or you could write about art and culture, which is something I did through the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas as well. And I think when you can accumulate that experience across different genres of writing, it really does inform your creative practice, which could then, and this is my third point, serve you in a writing residency. So I was fortunate to participate in grant-funded writing residencies, courtesy of both my university at the time and also the Charitable Arts Foundation. Like I said, in Aruba and Barbados, and not only did I meet other creatives from around the region, but I had this dedicated time to really invest in my practice and figure out what I wanted to say, you know. So and I say the last thing is because I think Alexia really touched on the submissions and being able to accept rejection. I think it's important to have mentors, you know. They could be your English teacher or they could be your mommy. Like, you know, I think as long as you have somebody who's in your corner who believes in what you do, and maybe may or may not point you in directions of where your work can be distributed, I think that's tremendously valuable. So yeah, I would say, you know, put your writing out there. And take part in every creative opportunity you can. And you might just run into a mentor. You might not even have to secure one yourself. So that would be my advice.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I just want to piggyback off of Ethan for a moment because, finding mentors, that is an incredibly useful way to encourage yourself to write. I remember when I first submitted a story to the Commonwealth Short Story Prize, it was rejected. It did not get far at all. But what I was offered was a week-long all expense paid workshop in Barbados to work with writers like Jacob Ross and Karen Lord. And those two became instrumental in, developing my writing. If I hadn't taken it, I did think they were going to steal my kidneys when I first got the invitation because I had no idea what I had submitted my short story to. But I met so many interesting people, so many great writers who I'm still in contact with, who continue to read my work and I read theirs. And I'm still in contact with those people today. And they've introduced me to so many other opportunities. So Karen Lord, she introduced me to the Clarion West Workshop for Science Fiction and Fantasy. Got an opportunity to take part in that workshop in 2023. It was 6 weeks. We wrote like I think about four, like five or six short stories, and it prepared me for my master's last year. So. And then, and even there, I met people like N.K. Jemisin, who is, of course, the award-winning writer of the fifth season science fiction and fantasy series. So it's about, putting yourself out there, as Ethan said, meeting new people, connecting yourself to people, and maintaining those relationships.
So what I'm hearing from both of you, basically courage and community, right? You have to have the courage to actually do the writing, you know, do the writing and have the courage to send it out and have other people read it and give you feedback and be available for feedback. And then building community. Each of you have gone off to different writing camps and, you know, programs internationally, but also locally as well. So I think that's really important for our listeners to hear, especially younger writers, right? Because writing can feel very personal and we treasure it and sometimes we hold it so close and we're afraid to put it out there. But I think both of you are saying that that's a important and necessary step in the process is allowing it to go out and receive the feedback.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
All right. Let me ask you all another question before we take our next break. What role do you think the University of the Bahamas can play in shaping the preservation of Bahamian literature, in encouraging our students to explore creative writing as a viable career path?
So I would begin by saying that the Blue Flamingo Literary Festival is definitely a great initiative, and I applaud Dr. Smith for his role in facilitating that. I was pleased to take part in last year's iteration, where I read from two of the stories from my collection, Between Islands, and that really gave me the confidence to speak about my work in public, because it's funny to say, but I had only really talked about my short stories primarily in like non-Bahamian context, either because I was studying abroad or because the writing residency I had participated in was not in the Bahamas. So it was nice to be able to have that space, and to be recognized and to be seen as a writer. So I felt like that was very affirming. I think going forward, and this may or may not, the onus may not be on the University of the Bahamas, but I do think it would be very valuable to have a national literary prize. At the launch, we discussed whether this would need to be a private or a public initiative, but whether or not it's public or private, I definitely think it needs to happen because there isn't really a mechanism or a platform to recognize Bahamian writing at the highest level when it comes to fiction. If you're an economic researcher, you might submit your paper to the Central Bank's competition, which is a very significant local academic competition. You have the Central Bank's also the fine arts competition that they hold too. And so I think the University of the Bahamas could potentially facilitate a national literary prize, because not only would that incentivize literary production, but it would also, I think, give weight and credibility to creative writing as a profession, as a viable path. I never thought that I could make a living writing, and that's what I'm doing. So I felt, I've always felt that I think, an essay competition is a good place to start, but we have to have a national literary prize to really, I think, catalyze creative writing in this country.
Well, Ethan took the words right out of my mouth. That was going to be the very thing I said. I just want to reaffirm that because I think that having a national literary prize would really solidify in the community's minds that this is a viable cultural resource. This is something that we can invest our time into, that we can invest our energies into. It's also reaffirming that literature is not just for children, because I don't know if Ethan has ever gotten this, but oftentimes, even today, when I speak about my writing, I sometimes get the question, like, are you writing for the BGCSE? Are you writing for the BJC? Not because I'm a teacher, simply because when we think about literature, I think we think about how high awards go for literature in the country. And I think so far we have quite a few essay competitions that are geared towards secondary school, primary school, at some point to the tertiary division. But that's as far as it goes. It's almost as if we leave literature behind once we graduate. So having a literary prize would, I guess, give us an opportunity to say this is something that we value in our community. This is something that we value in our culture. So that's amazing. I think that the university is also doing a great job developing a creative writing major, if I'm correct.
You are
So,
correct.
yes, I'm so excited about that. I wish I'd had it, but I think that the literature program, the critical analysis program, did a great job inspiring writers to write creatively already. But having that as a major would, I think, give more parents and family members the courage to allow their students to go off and pursue degrees in writing. I think that that's one of the things that stopped my mother when I was in high school, because when I was applying to colleges, I wanted to get into literature, but she was scared about what that would mean for me. She didn't think that it could be something that would sustain me. Now she does.
But look at you now.
Look at me now. But now she does. It took a long time to get there, though. And I think that even now, sometimes, you know, certain family members, they are a little bit skeptical about how far I can go with it. But again, having that creative writing program would give it, I guess, a sort of legitimacy in the zygote, right?
Yes. All right. So we're at that point again in the program for our last break of the show. So we'll be right back. You're listening to University Drive. More after this.
The one big draw of doing a doctoral degree here is that you don't have to move and you don't have to take your family to a different place, and so you can do it right here. The same abilities that you would have in a UK or with America with being able to research is available here. And we now have all these facilities, and so they can take advantage of it at a much cheaper cost to the individual.
My name is Jeannie Gibson. I'm the policy assistant here at the Government and Public Policy Institute. The series that we normally do on a quarterly basis, one of those is Meet the Policymakers series, is to actually engage the policymakers to discuss relevant policies to what's going on relating to those policies here in the country, as well as to give the public an opportunity to hear and actually discuss it with the policymakers.
Welcome to Independence Cafeteria, home of affordable, diverse, and delectable dishes that your taste buds will love. Choose from our everyday menu of baked chicken, wings, or fish fingers, or our extensive salad bar. Build your own pasta, grab something hot from the grill, or ask about our special of the day. Our full team of culinary professionals can't wait to serve you. We're located in Independence Park at University of the Bahamas' Oaksfield campus. Call us at 302-4390. Download the app or order online at www.independencecafeteria.com. Your taste buds will thank you.
Welcome back to University Drive and our conversation on Bahamian literature. Our guests are Alexia Tolis and Reese Knowles. It's been an amazing conversation so far. We've talked about the inspiration for our writers, their ideas about the importance in Bahamian writers writing Bahamian stories and showing the complexity of the Bahamian experience. In our last section, we talked about the role of the university in developing young Bahamian writers and providing a space for Bahamians to build their voice. Alexia, you've been writing for years now. You started, or at least you were engaging in the process as a student at the University of the Bahamas. What would you say to young Bahamians who have stories to tell but don't know where to start?
I think a great place to start would be reading the literature that's coming out of your country and your wider region. One of the things that inspired me to write was actually being in a class with you, Dr. Smith. I remember it was Caribbean writers, I think it was Caribbean Discourse 1, and we wanted to see more literature about our region, about our country, not just from the past, but also in the present and the future. We wanted to see stories that didn't just lament about what was happening previously, but talking about us surviving and thriving in our present day. So I think that, you know, reading more literature from your country, from your region, is a great place to start. Also exploring different genres. I think that something that we kind of pigeonhole ourselves into is that Caribbean writing and post-colonial writing is just within literary fiction, but there's a lot of cross genres. And so, you know, feel free to explore different genres. For instance, one of my favorite Caribbean novels is by Sherry Jones. She's a Bayesian writer, and she wrote this beautiful story called How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps Her House. It is a literary crime novel, and it's one of the reasons why I was inspired to write a literary crime novel, which I'm currently working on. Just exploring different genres, but first starting off within your region, within your country, to just remind yourself that you're not someone that's isolated. You do come from a community of people who are writing about stories that you relate to, that you about characters that you understand. So yeah, I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah, and Alexia, the check is in the mail. Okay, thanks for that.
Yes.
Reese, what role does access to books and literary spaces play in shaping a culture of reading and writing?
You definitely, so I'm a little conflicted, right? Because I got a Kindle. And now I have access to a bunch of different books that I ordinarily wouldn't have been able to source. And so I think one way to answer this question is by saying that we need to expand access to salient texts, both in schools and in libraries, and also in bookshops locally. But I do believe, you know, we are a country where the digital divide is not extremely pronounced. I would say most Bahamians benefit from internet access. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but in my experience, that is the case. And so I think we have a responsibility to take an initiative and turn our own lives into a kind of curriculum. So I don't just read, I'd say, because I think something is a classic, or because maybe it has a captivating cover. I'm really interested in feeling out a text and seeing what how I respond to it, and if I'm not responding to it, letting it go, you know? So I think, of course, some communities lack access to books. And I think like it's not always easy to find the time if you have other, let's say, demands on your time outside of school, whether that's, you know, professional or otherwise. But B, I think it's really crucial for writers to take initiative and to seek out those texts which will change their lives and will influence their practice. I didn't read very, very much a few years ago, not because I was like too busy, but I just found it very difficult to find, let's say, texts that were affordable and that were I was interested in. Now that I have access to a platform where I can read things digitally and source texts much more easily, I find it much easier to read, to really to be enriched by literature and stuff like that. So I would say if it's within one's means, I think exploring other ways to get those texts into your hands would be viable and valuable. Because, yeah, I think one of the biggest hurdles to reading is, you know, not only financial, but also like convenience and access, as you said. So I would explore digital literary tools and maybe book exchanges. I have a good friend, Sasha, who does these book exchanges locally. And so I always try to go take some texts and then swap them out, meet people. And that's another way in which I try to engage with the literary community locally and discuss what's being read and what to read.
But also, what about libraries? Do people use libraries anymore? Because that's actually the function of libraries, right? Libraries is supposed to be this space that's open where people don't have to spend money, but they can go in and they can check out books and they can read and they can be exposed to the world through literature, right? What do you think, what's happening with our libraries? Why aren't our libraries being used more? I also remember, I think it was a few years ago, that someone had started placing these small compartments on trees throughout Nassau, I believe, where they would put books and people could just come and take a book and then return it once they finished reading it. I think that was here. Does this sound familiar to you guys?
Yeah, there's one at Goodman's Bay.
Okay, yes, I thought so. I think more of those, because I think you make a good point, Reese, in terms of accessibility. And unfortunately, there are parts of the community where we don't have access to electricity all the time, or access to the internet all the time, right? Or even have, there are some of us who don't have these devices, right? But I mean, we can go lo-fi, we can go to the books, we can go to the libraries. And I don't know how many bookstores are now still functioning outside of Chapter One, the bookstore at Harbor Bay. Are there any, what are the bookstores where people can go in and physically hold a book as well? Because I think sometimes too, people are a little bit intimidated by the online and whatnot. Are we aware of the other bookstores here that can provide a space for folks to come in and read?
Well, Rabble Bookshop Alexi, you want to go?
No, go ahead. You can go ahead first.
All right. So Rabble Bookshop, which is by Alicia Wallace, just recently opened up, and that's located at Ponciana Paper Press at Parkade Road. Okay. I'm also thinking about Black Food Bookshop. I forget the street address, but that's also another bookshop. I also actually this is one thing that I did personally as well. Because I think it's hard to find a book that costs less than $20. But if you go to the Humane Society thrift shop, about half the books on my shelf are from the Humane Society bookshop, and they only sell them for like $1. And they have a lot of books.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing. You know, a lot of my books, they come from the thrift shop at the Bahamas Humane Society. It's always very interesting to see what kind of books are, you know, coming out from that little thrift shop, because a lot of these are like current books, they're modern books, they're books that were on the Booker Prize list, and it's amazing they're like a dollar. But I've always wondered, like, why can't we have those in a library? And I think that one of the most heartbreaking moments for me was when Buy the Book, that was located on Saunders Beach, closed down, because I don't remember the owner's name, but she always had such interesting books in the shop. Unfortunately, the cost of bringing in the books made it as inaccessible as digital platforms. You know, a book costing $20, $30, that's almost like an investment for some people. That's something that they're going to have to really think about when they can get so many things that are cheaper. And then, of course, there's, I think, again, the idea that a lot of the libraries that we have here in New Providence are mostly geared towards children. So once again, I think it's that mentality. I think it's about, you know, like putting the resources towards a library that's maybe specifically geared towards adults, maybe putting the word out there. I don't know what that would look like. But I think, again, it's like just encouraging more people to think about literature, not as something that we graduate from, that we leave behind in our childhoods, but something that we move on into adulthood. Because as the thrift shops will show you, people are reading. It's just that, you know, again, finding the space and making it affordable, and also putting the word out there. Because I did not know about Black Food. I had no idea about that bookshop, right? Mm-hmm. And that could be because I've just returned, or it could be just because people aren't talking about it. People probably are talking about it in certain spaces. So yeah, I think.
So, I thank you guys for coming out. This was an enlightening conversation. Alexia, Reese, thank you for sharing your experiences, your passion for storytelling, and your thoughts on the future of Bahamian literature. And hopefully we can continue the conversation another time. Hopefully moving forward, we can get together and create more reading opportunities, more opportunities to build community and to meet other writers, Bahamian writers, and work with them to get their stories out as well. So that's it for today's episode of University Drive. I'm Dr. Craig Smith. Until next time, keep learning, keep creating, and keep telling your story.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.